Welcome to the Science Podcast for May 24th, 2013. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, paying for blood, cockroach resilience, and the fate of the wolves on Isle Royale.
These random chance events, especially as the population gets smaller, are really important for the fate of the population.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
The world is in constant need of blood. There aren't enough donors to meet demand, and banked blood only lasts so long. In a policy forum this week, Nicola Lecetera presents evidence that certain types of incentives might encourage donation without compromising quality. I spoke with him about the latest research and what it means for policy.
So the key motivation for this article, and in fact as well as for other studies that my co-authors and I have conducted, is to understand what can be done to address the chronic shortage of blood supply for transfusion, a shortage that is present in developed countries but is even more severe in the developing world. So what we notice is that there is a general aversion by many organizations and blood collection agencies toward any form of economic rewards to be used to motivate blood donation. And we set out to investigate to what extent actually the available empirical evidence on providing incentives for blood donations is or is not consistent with this position.
Let's start with the history of this. So the World Health Organization and many other agencies do not think that economic incentives for blood donation is a good idea. Why has this been their position?
There have been historically two main concerns. On the one hand, there is a concern about the motivation that economic incentives might give, especially for activities that have an altruistic or pro-social kind of inherent component. The idea here is that by providing economic incentives, you might in fact reduce or lessen the motivations of people to donate blood in this case, and also this might actually backfire. And the second concern is with the quality or the safety of blood. There is a belief that providing incentives will attract certain types of people who are, for example, more likely to carry some transfusion-transmissible diseases, historically hepatitis, for example, and starting in the 80s, in particular, HIV. So these are the two key motivations and two key concerns here.
In your article, you talk about the various types of evidence available regarding the use of monetary compensation for blood donation. Can we start with the survey results that look at payment and economic rewards and people's feelings about blood donation?
Yes, the evidence from surveys and lab studies are to a large extent consistent and supporting concerns that I was mentioning earlier, and in some sense are the foundation for those concerns. Mm-hmm. What emerges from the study is that subjects state a higher aversion to rewards which have a more sort of direct or obvious economic component, say cash or, for example, lottery tickets. Conversely, hypothetical rewards with less of an immediate economic value or content seem to be perceived more favorably, an example being free health tests, for example, a cholesterol test.
Okay. But when you move these types of studies into the into an observational or experimental setting, you do see a difference.
Yes, we do see quite a remarkable difference. So on a methodological ground, the two key differences in field studies are first that they typically rely on larger and more representative samples, and very crucially, rather than looking at, you know, hypothetical or stated behavior, asking hypothetical questions, proposing hypothetical rewards, these studies are about actual incentives for actual behavior, in this case, donation behavior. And the evidence here is very consistently showing a positive impact of these economic rewards. Interestingly, the evidence is positive for a wide variety of economic incentives, ranging, for example, from gift cards to a paid day off work. And it's also somewhat similar across different countries. There are studies in the U.S., in Switzerland, Italy, and Argentina. For a subset of these studies, finally, there is also some information on the effect of providing these incentives on the donor eligibility or blood safety. And the studies that have this type of information consistently show no negative impact on eligibility or blood safety of providing these incentives.
Okay. Well, but none of these studies actually offered straight cash or money.
Right.
Is that the next step for looking into this?
So that's right. So no study that has looked at actual behavior has looked at, you know, direct cash. The main reason being that in many countries, you know, offering cash reward is prohibited, or at least the blood that is obtained from donors compensated with cash cannot be labeled as coming from volunteer donors. So, yes, it would be interesting to test for this. It would be interesting to look at the differences that different types of economic rewards, including cash, have on behavior. What can be, in our opinion, particularly relevant here is looking at how different framings or interpretation of the rewards can play a role. For example, cash might be perceived more as a direct, you know, form of payment as opposed to other incentive items being seen by the receivers or the potential receiver as gifts or, you know, signs of gratitude. And this might have an effect on the responses. In fact, if I can add a point, in all of the studies that have looked at incentives for blood donations, in the field studies in particular, the rewards were not conditional on a successful donation, but only on presenting or showing up to donate. The idea here is, by doing so, you reduce or eliminate the risk of people misreporting their health status. For example, they have to fill in a questionnaire typically before donating in order to receive the reward. So in some sense, you might think that cash, at least in principle, can be more perceived as a conditional payment or sort of a payment for performance as opposed to other items that might be more perceived as unconditional in some sense. So these are all, you know, aspects that would be definitely interesting to test in the future.
Definitely. So taking a step back, now that you've looked across all these different studies, what kind of policy implications do these findings have?
So yeah, we dedicate quite a bit of space in the article to discuss how the available field-based evidence can inform policy. Mm-hmm. And clearly, the first order insight is that incentives, economic incentives, might indeed help alleviating the chronic shortage of blood for transfusion. And there are also some additional results that are relevant here. For example, in a study that actually Mario Machis, Bob Slonim, and I did, we find that providing incentives in certain periods does lead people to change their donation schedule over time. And this is really important because the supply of blood is kind of seasonal. There are periods of the year where, you know, people donate less, while on the other hand, you know, the demand for blood is chronic and blood cannot be stored for a long time. So any policies that might help smoothing out the supply of blood over time, just like this incentive seems to be doing, should be taken into consideration. On the other hand, you know, details matter a lot here, and we, again, in the article, clarify how certain particular ways in which these incentives are proposed, are presented, might have an impact.
Do you think these findings about the economic rewards for donation, that they're universally applicable? Can they expand out to other countries besides the ones looked at so far?
This is a great point, and the fact that the evidence comes from more than one country is somewhat suggestive of some broad applicability. On the other hand, especially when incentives, motivations, socially desirable activities are involved, local norms, local culture might actually play a big role on how, for example, the incentives are perceived. Just to give an example from the existing evidence, the American Red Cross offers T-shirts at some blood drives, and they seem to be pretty successful in attracting donors. Conversely, an experiment done in Argentina where, among other things, T-shirts were offered showed that, you know, there was no effect of providing T-shirts, just to give an example. So we always have to be, you know, very careful when generalizing. And, you know, granted, more research from different contexts is highly welcome and highly needed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
Nicola Lecetera is the author of a policy forum on economic rewards for blood donations in this week's Science.
Hey, podcast listeners, this week's show is sponsored by Audible, and there's a special deal being offered to our listeners. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you can get a free audiobook of your choice.
And as usual, we're offering some suggestions. I'm going to go with 1491 by Charles C. Mann, one of Science's contributing correspondents.
All right. I hope you get a chance to check out that book and more from Audible. And don't forget, you can get a free download just for signing up at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag. are constantly changing the world around us, forcing other organisms to adapt or die. Those adaptations can be seen, for example, in bacterial resistance to antibiotics. Even more recently, cockroaches are becoming resistant to some forms of bait. Kobe Shaw and colleagues investigated the mechanisms behind this resistance, ultimately focusing in on gustatory receptor neurons, or taste cells, found in the sensilla, or tiny hairs around cockroach mouth parts. Shaw spoke with me about getting to the bottom of this cockroach conundrum.
This work is just one chapter in this arms race between us and cockroaches. Back in the mid-1980s, the pest control industry started switching from using spray-based insecticide to using baits. And the bait combines an insecticide with various types of nutrients, including sugars and glucose, for example. And these nutrients stimulate the cockroach to eat the bait. About 20 years ago, my colleague and co-author, Jules Silverman, discovered that this highly effective bait started to lose its effectiveness and failed to control cockroach infestations. We know that usually these types of failures are due to either misapplication of a bait or to physiological resistance by the cockroach to the insecticide or the active ingredient in the formulation. But Jules discovered that, in fact, what was happening here was that the cockroach became averse to a glucose. He also discovered that this glucose aversion trait was heritable. That is, it had a genetic basis. So our project picks up on this and shows the neural mechanism that's underlying this really interesting behavior.
So your first tip-off that something was amiss was when cockroaches stopped taking the bait, literally. What led you to suspect that this was glucose aversion?
So there are two major hypotheses. One hypothesis would be that something in the central nervous system, in the brain of the cockroach, has changed. And the second hypothesis is that something in the peripheral sensory system, the taste system, has changed. And so we decided to investigate the latter. The peripheral nervous system is easier and much more tractable as an experimental model. So a postdoc in the laboratory, Ayako Wada Katsumata, then used a combination of behavioral tests or behavioral assays and electrophysiological recordings from the taste sensilla to investigate what was happening. In fact, she found that everything was happening at the peripheral sensory system, and the cockroaches were tasting glucose as a bitter compound rather than as a sweet compound as we do.
So how exactly do cockroaches sense taste? Do they have tongues or taste buds the same way that humans do?
So there are really a lot of functional similarities between how cockroaches do it and how humans do it, but we should point out also there are some huge differences. So both us and cockroaches have what you might call taste buds. In cockroaches, they're called sensilla or taste hairs, and these allow the cockroach to detect taste and to discriminate among different chemicals. There are huge differences, though, between us and cockroaches. Cockroaches have a decentralized system, so they can taste with their mouth, but they can also taste with their antennae. They can taste with their feet, with their legs, with their wings. They have taste hairs distributed throughout the body of the cockroach.
And so here you were studying only the taste hairs around the mouth.
That's correct. We concentrate on the mouth because we're interested in compounds that are bitter, and bitter compounds are generally tasted and avoided after tasting with the mouth.
So they sense the same sort of major tastes that humans do in the sense that sweet is generally good and bitter is generally bad.
Yes, cockroaches are very similar to humans in that they have several different taste modalities or taste qualities, but they're slightly different from humans. We have five major tastes: salt, sour, bitter, sweet, and umami or savory. Cockroaches are known to have sweet, which corresponds to our sweet, bitter, but they don't sense sour as we do. Instead, they have neurons that specialize for detecting osmotic concentration or ionic strength of solutions, and for detecting salts.
Okay, so you said in these glucose-averse cockroaches that essentially glucose was activating the bitter receptor. It tasted bitter to cockroaches. Tell me a little bit more about how you came to that conclusion.
We investigated which neurons different compounds stimulated. And so, for example, when you stimulate a cockroach with fructose, you get a specific type of neural response, and you can identify a specific cell, gustatory-receptor neuron, that responds to fructose. When you stimulate a normal cockroach with a compound like caffeine, which tastes bitter to the cockroach, a different cell within the sensory hair responds to caffeine. So we can distinguish the neural signal from these two different cells. We can then conduct cross-adaptation studies where we adapt the cell so it no longer responds to fructose. If we adapt the cell to fructose and then provide that sensillum with caffeine, a bitter compound, the caffeine cell responds, the fructose cell does not respond, obviously. And so we discovered that in the glucose-averse cockroaches, glucose stimulated both the sugar gustatory receptor neuron as well as the bitter gustatory receptor neuron that normally responds to caffeine.
Why is it that the bitter would override the sweet taste cells so much as to make the cockroaches averse to the glucose?
What's very common for cockroaches and for us, in fact, is that bitter tends to override sweet. The bitter taste is a signal for something that may be toxic. Now, a little bit of sweetness associated with bitterness does not override the fact that bitterness is associated with something being toxic. So all animals have evolved to avoid something that contains a little bit of sweetness and allow bitterness.
So as you said, this has only been happening, as far as you know, around the last 20 or 30 years. How did this happen so quickly?
Yes, to our knowledge, this is only something that happened recently, but we need to keep in mind that this has not been examined before, so it could have been an ancient trait as well. We actually suggest three different possibilities for why we have this glucose aversion. The first possibility, as you suggested, is that this trait evolved rapidly within just a few years because of the use of insecticide-containing baits. But another possibility is that glucose aversion may actually be a very ancient trait, and that cockroaches evolved this trait in response to eating toxic compounds. There are many toxic compounds that contain glucose plus a nasty molecule, and those are called glucosides. When cockroaches move to the human environment, they may have lost the trait, or the trait may have gone to a very low level within the population. But then when we introduce baits that contain an insecticide and glucose, that trait becomes selected for. It's an adaptive trait, and the frequency of that trait may have increased in populations of cockroaches. A third possibility, and one that we're looking at now, is that this trait actually was introgressed into the German cockroach through hybridization with other cockroaches that may have glucose aversion. And of course, this requires looking at other cockroach species to see how common glucose aversion is in other species.
So what does this mean from an evolutionary perspective?
The system has really uncovered a very interesting mechanism, actually the only neural mechanism that we have now for behavioral resistance in insects. There are many insects that are known to have developed behavioral resistance to insecticides, but the underlying sensory mechanisms are not known. And so this research is the first to identify the cellular mechanism of this natural variation in behavior that results in an adapted behavior, so it takes the arms race to a new level.
And what does this mean for pest control?
So there are at least two major implications to the pest control industry. The first one is very obvious, that we should incorporate other phagostimulants, other compounds that stimulate feeding into baits other than glucose. And in fact, the agrochemical industry has started doing this already to try to get around this glucose aversion. The second implication of this is we know that cockroaches have this amazing associative learning capacity. They can associate a taste with an odor that emanates from the bait. And so if they taste glucose in a bait and that gives them a bad feeling of something bitter, they can associate the odor of that bait with a bad experience. So the Pavlovian type of learning, and avoid the bait altogether in subsequent encounters. They don't even need to go near the bait. So our suggestion to manufacturers of baits would be to create sort of a smorgasbord of bait formulations where both the bait ingredients and the insecticide and the odorants associated with the bait are randomized. So cockroaches can't learn and remember and associate a bait with a specific odor.
Very interesting. Kobi Schall, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Kobi Schall and colleagues write about glucose aversion in cockroaches in a report this week.
After yielding more than 60 years of ecological and evolutionary data, a natural experiment in Isle Royale could come to an end. I spoke with Christine Malott about the history of the animals that call the island home and what the future might hold for them.
I certainly was familiar with Isle Royale from college biology classes, ecology. It's been around for so long, and I had actually written about it a couple of times previously, but in 2011, I had the great chance to get there on a summer trip. It's a bit of a challenge to get there. You've got to take a boat ride from either the Upper Peninsula of Michigan or Canada, and it's a 3 to 6 hour boat ride on Lake Superior, which is not always calm. It's a wilderness island. It's a national park since 1940. There are no roads, so once you get there, you're on your own, 2 feet, or on a boat or a kayak. We had a canoe with us, and we managed to arrange a visit with Rolf Peterson, who's been the lead researcher on this Wolf Moose project since he was a graduate student in the 1970s. They live in an old fishing cabin on the island, and it's sort of become their summer research headquarters. That's where I sort of just got reintroduced to some of their current research and learned about the tenuous state of the wolves. Even then, in 2011, they had pretty much dwindled from their peaks around 1980. So I just started paying more attention to the project, and there was big news out of it this year, which is the reason for the science piece that we're running this week.
So what is going on with Isle Royale right now?
The wolves are basically at the lowest point they've ever been. They're not doing well. Last year, in 2012, there were no pups born. The researchers typically spend time in the summer listening for the young pups, the yips that they make. It's a pretty interesting distinctive sound that they can pick out compared to the howls of adult wolves. Or they will find trails of pup prints around the denning sites, and none of that happened in the summer, so they were concerned because the number of females and the number of adults were down to 9 last year as well. Again, from a high of 50, they've been down and up and then down again. There's been concern for a long time about this population, and their official count of the population takes place in winter. In January, the researchers fly out and do aerial counts. They did not see any pups in January of this year, so 2012 might be the last time that the population didn't have any pups.
And what is the moose population like right now on the island?
Well, since the wolves have been declining, they've actually ticked up in the past couple of years. I think 4 years ago, they were down to about 400, which was concerning, and they think it had to do with extremely hot summers that had been happening. Moose are very cold adapted, but this past year was great for the moose. They've been up to over 1,000 in the past, but you know, clearly without the wolf predation going on, they seem to be having a better time of it.
This unique predator-prey system has provided data for many important ecological findings. Can you walk us through some of the more important ones?
Yeah, the study started in 1959. It was one of the first, actually, to provide indisputable evidence that wolves are selective in their predation. They aren't just random killers and taking any and all of their prey. Moose are actually really difficult to hunt. They prey primarily on calves and then on old and infirm moose, and I think that's their biggest source of sustenance. When there are a lot of old and infirm moose in some years, you know, the wolves do really well. They've got a lot to feed on. So that idea had, there had been suggestions of it from other earlier research in the 1940s, but Isle Royale was really the place to confirm and really nail that down. There was a paper in Science in 1994 out of this study that found that the food chain on Isle Royale is actually controlled by the wolves, by wolf predation on the moose. And this was one of the first studies to show that sort of top-down control in a terrestrial system. And they did this by examining annual tree rings, and there was a correlation with moose population. When trees do better when the wolves are high and the moose are low.
You also point out in your article the role that random events have taken in the life of this island. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, that's really key. It's actually how the study started itself. In 1949, it was a cold winter, and the stretch of Lake Superior between Ontario and the island froze over. It happens from time to time. So these wolves arrived and started a population that's been thriving for a lot of years, but these random chance events, especially as the population gets smaller, are really important for the fate of the population. In 1980, the population went from a high of 50, which is a record high for wild wolves in nature, and it started to crash and eventually was down to about a dozen. And later they found out that canine parvovirus, this really deadly virus for domestic dogs, had been brought to the island by a visitor who had brought a dog along illegally. I think the biggest chance occurrence and a pretty interesting story happened in 1997. It turns out a large alpha male wolf from Canada made the ice crossing that winter and basically took over the island. And he was just a really prolific breeder. He mated with one of the females on the island and then later with his own daughter and altogether had 34 offspring. They were able to figure this out in a really interesting way. They collect a lot of scat from the wolves and can do a DNA analysis based on markers that they find on the DNA. In addition, they've had stores of blood and bone samples that they've collected over the decades. In 2007, a postdoctoral researcher came on and joined the project, Jennifer Adams, and it was her job to go through all these things and see what they had to tell. She noticed one particular marker coming up, which had been present in the population for a long time. And then as she went through later years, she noticed another marker on the Y chromosome pop up. And then when she put together a pedigree based on those markers, all of the individuals that had that new marker traced back to one individual wolf. They had been observing this wolf. He was a bigger wolf than once they'd been used to seeing, and he turned whiter as he aged, and so they had nicknamed him the Old Gray Guy. And their first observation of him was in 1998. They noticed that he had taken over as breeder of one of the packs, and 1997 happened to have been another year of ice forming between the island and Canada. And they realized what had happened, that this was an immigrant from Canada who had invaded, as wolves had done in the past, and literally genetically took over the island. Again, a chance event that really turned the population's fortunes around for at least another decade and a half.
And with this dwindling population, no reproduction this year, and a lot of inbreeding problems, can this classic predator-prey system be saved, and should it be saved?
Yeah, that is the good, hard question. It's been a hands-off study for the most part. Up until 1988, they hadn't radio-collared or handled the wolves at all. After the canine parvovirus infection, they did get permission from the National Park Service to live capture and test the wolves. It's an isolated, contained system, and they've been left alone. So there's a lot of reluctance to do anything about their dwindling numbers here. Peterson has long maintained that, you know, this natural experiment should just run its course. And if they go extinct, they go extinct. They have maintained that wolves should be present on Isle Royal as long as there are moose because, as they've showed, the moose will just overbrowse and really wreak havoc on the forest. But as long as wolves are there, they can actually keep the moose in check. So there's been a reluctance to do anything about their dwindling numbers. But after some conversations with geneticists and starting to get public input, they are starting to lean to, at least in terms of science, they're thinking about possibly conducting a genetic rescue, which means bringing in wolves, probably from Ontario in this case, while there still are existing wolves on Isle Royal, letting them breed and perpetuate the population that's been there. And this long-term data set for science has been really crucial. It's really taught us a lot, and a lot of researchers would like to see that keep going. On the other hand, this is a wilderness. It's a national park. Is it right to use these wolves for science? Shouldn't they just be left alone? A counterargument to that is that, well, that would be the best thing in an ideal world, but the island is affected by climate change, for example. The ice bridges are far and few between. I think the last one was in 2008, and before that was in 1997. But in the 60s, they happened every couple of winters, so the chance of another wolf naturally getting there and reviving the population is pretty slim. But ultimately, the decision rests with the National Park Service. They've put together a big team of about 20 policy experts and wildlife biology experts and others, and hope to come up with a set of options for the Park Service, which will then be made public in fall. And then it will go through a process under the National Environmental Policy Act, in which there's more public input, and then the park superintendent at Isle Royale will ultimately decide about what should happen.
Well, Christine Mollat, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christine Mollat writes about the science, history, and future of Isle Royale in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, I'm Carrie Klein, and I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's going to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our online daily news site. So, Dave, in our first story, we're talking about friendly viruses. As we learn more about our microbiome, we learn that bacteria can be both friends and foes, and now a new study tells us that the same might be true for viruses.
Right, Carrie. This microbiome is the population of bacteria that we have on our body. And recent studies have shown this bacteria can actually be very helpful. For example, one recent study showed that the bacteria on our face can actually help prevent acne. And researchers have shown that bacteria in our guts can actually help us potentially even lose weight. But nobody's really looked at the viruses that live on us. And there are actually a lot of viruses that live on us as well. Viruses tend to inhabit mucus. And mucus is, of course, the slimy substance. It coats the inside of our mouths, our nose, eyelids, and our digestive tract. It's got bacteria in it. And this new study reveals that it actually has a lot of phages in it, too. And phages are basically viruses that invade and kill bacteria.
So what are these phages in this mucus doing?
Well, that's what the researchers set out to figure out. And what they found was they grew human lung tissue in the lab. And lungs are one of the body surfaces that are protected by mucus in humans. And the researchers had E. coli, which can be a very dangerous bacterium, invade this lung tissue. And what they found was that the lung tissue that didn't have a protective coating of mucus that also contained phages in it fared a lot worse than the lung tissue that had mucus but did have phages in it, which suggests that the phages are critical for fighting off these harmful bacteria.
So the mucus itself may not actually be as protective as the phages that it carries.
Right, exactly. The mucus probably has a protective aspect, but it's really these phages that are inside the mucus that are helping to defend us. And what's really interesting is we're obviously not the only animal that has mucus. There's a lot of creatures on Earth that have mucus, worms and corals, for example. And the researchers found where they looked at the mucus of a lot of these species, they were finding phages in them, which suggests that phages actually may play an important part in a sort of immune system for a lot of species on Earth.
So it sounds like this could really provide a lot of insight into diseases that affect mucosal membranes like the lungs, the bowels, things like that.
Exactly. And actually, one of the diseases mentioned in this article is inflammatory bowel disease. And we know we have this ecosystem of hundreds of bacterial species in our gut, but patients with IBD have a disrupted ecosystem with different dominant species. It's possible that the phages are actually playing a role in this, that viruses are attacking certain bacteria and not attacking others. And one way to combat IBD may not be to focus on the bacteria, but actually to focus on some of the viruses that live in our guts.
And in our next story, we're talking about how Neanderthal mothers cared for their young. Ancient teeth from our ancestors have been extremely useful in learning about how they lived, and now we're even learning about how baby Neanderthals may have been fed.
That's right, Carrie. Teeth can actually tell us a lot of stuff. The simple morphology of teeth can reveal what species they came from, what kind of diets they had, but nobody's really looked at how teeth can actually shed light on breastfeeding behavior. And the reason teeth can even shed light on this in the first place is because you can sort of think of teeth as tree rings in a sense. Every day they lay down layers of dentine and enamel. And this dentine and enamel actually contains traces of a chemical called barium, which is an element similar to calcium. And it's present in water sources and many types of soil. It's also present in high levels in breast milk. So you can imagine when a baby is breastfeeding, there's going to be a lot of layers containing high levels of barium in those very early rings of the teeth because the baby's drinking a lot of breast milk. But when the baby is weaned off the breast milk, you're going to have less barium because there's going to be less barium in their diet. We know that's the case for humans. And the question in this study is, how can we take that knowledge and apply it to other animals and even potentially Neanderthals to figure out how other species practice their weaning behavior?
Can breast milk be distinguished from other kinds of milk and other sources of calcium in our diet?
Well, the interesting thing with humans is actually a lot of human babies, after they're weaned off breast milk, actually go to infant formula, which actually has higher levels of barium, which also can reveal some interesting information. If you see all of a sudden this spike in barium, you might assume, okay, well, this baby maybe had breast milk for 6 months, and then maybe for the next 6 months had formula, and then maybe you'll see this big drop in barium, and you'll say, okay, well, now it looks like the baby's being weaned off breast milk and infant formula altogether and is eating more of a normal diet, which has a lot less barium in it.
Okay, so you said that these analyses have been pretty accurate on human babies. So what did we find with Neanderthal teeth?
Well, the researchers actually only looked at one Neanderthal tooth, and this was from a child that lived about 100,000 years ago. This is a molar found in a cave in Belgium. And the researchers did some laser scanning of the tooth, which allowed them to look at all these different layers of the tooth. And what they found was that the barium level started off pretty high right after birth, and they continued to be elevated for 7 months. And this suggests that this baby was exclusively breastfeeding for 7 months. Then the barium levels fell to intermediate levels for another 7 months. And this suggests that the mother's milk was being supplemented by other food sources. So the baby was still getting breast milk, but possibly also eating other food as well. And then after about 1.2 years, the barium levels really dropped off. And this suggests that the child wasn't drinking any breast milk anymore and potentially was actually very abruptly weaned from the breast milk and really just sort of forced to eat more normal foods.
Okay, so in this particular example, this baby started to be weaned around 7 months, and then a little over a year, it appeared to be fully weaned. Is this earlier or later than we expected from Neanderthals?
It's pretty early, and it's also a lot earlier than is seen in modern humans, especially those humans that live in non-industrial societies, where weaning doesn't actually take place until about 30 months. And this analysis of this Neanderthal tooth suggests that Neanderthals were weaned very early in life, which also suggests that they might have developed a lot faster than we did, which is actually a going hypothesis. Experts caution, you won't want to make sweeping conclusions just based on one tooth found in one cave, but it is really sort of a nice affirmation of this technique, which shows just how much information is available simply by looking for this one element in the sort of tree rings of teeth.
And our last story is about penguins and why they don't fly. We know of a lot of flightless birds out there. There are emus and ostriches and also penguins. But I don't know that we necessarily know why they don't fly.
We don't really. We know that penguins are very good swimmers. And there's been this suspicion that perhaps in order to become very good swimmers, they had to give up flight to make themselves much more effective in the water. This new study lends a lot of support to that idea. It's a study of a type of bird called the murre, which is a penguin-like seabird. What's different about these birds versus penguins is they can still fly and they swim, but they're not great either, especially flying. They're actually pretty bad flyers. And the researchers said, well, maybe we can look at this bird who's sort of almost maybe in this transition stage, not really a great swimmer, not really a great flyer, but can do both. Maybe that'll provide some clues into why penguins have given up flight.
So did they answer that question?
They think they did. What they did was they looked at a group of murres that nest on cliffs in Alaska, Canada, and other northerly sites. And studying these murres wasn't easy, especially in northern Canada. The researchers actually had to carry shotguns loaded with rubber bullets to ward off the local polar bears. They lived in a cabin surrounded by an electric bear fence. Don't let anybody ever tell you that science can't be dangerous work. When they actually were able to get the murres, they outfitted them with sensors so they could get a sense of how deep they dove, how much time they spent in the air. And what they found was these animals expended a lot of energy when they flew, more than any other bird. Hmm. In fact, on the wing, MERS burn energy at 31 times the rate they do at rest, the highest known ratio of any bird. When other vertebrates work really hard, they're burning energy only at 25 times their resting rate. So these birds are really working hard just to be bad flyers.
And what about how they swim?
And they swim okay. They were more efficient than many other birds that swim, but they're still not great swimmers. The researchers found that comparing with penguins of the same size, MERS expended far more energy while diving.
And so what does this mean for penguins who can only do one?
Well, what the researchers hypothesize is if the MERS wing became a bit more like the penguin's stubby flipper, they would be a lot better swimmers. But their ability to fly would almost be impossible. And what it suggests is that penguins may have reached a very similar point in their evolutionary history where they were able to fly a bit, able to swim a bit, but weren't able to do both very well. And for some reason decided, you know what? Life's going to be a lot easier if I just swim, but I'm a much more successful swimmer. Maybe there's a lot more food in the water, especially if I'm diving down. And so from an evolutionary perspective, it made sense for them to evolve into a place where they just became these awesome swimmers, and it was worth it to give up flight. And MERS really are shedding light on this really sort of transitional point in evolution. Animals obviously are not consciously making this decision, but where this decision is made over evolutionary history.
All right. And what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a fascinating physics story that deals with the phenomenon of entanglement. This is the idea that if you observe a photon in one place, it'll actually affect the behavior of a photon in another place, potentially another place that's light years away. It's this really bizarre property that Einstein called spooky action at a distance. Now researchers have shown that if you observe a photon at one time, you can actually affect another photon at a different time. So entanglement may not just work across space, but also across time. For Science Insider, we continue to explore the impact of the sequester. This week, the impact on biomedical research labs. Also a story about whether journals should abandon the impact factor. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the DSM-5, the latest, what's called the Bible of psychiatry, whether it's still valuable or should be ditched. Next week's Science Live is about the ethics of studying chimpanzees in captivity. Should we abandon captivity for chimps and just study them in the wild? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now, Science Policy from Science Insider, and Science Live, live chats on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the May 24th, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.